Social Justice at Northwestern University, co-author with Afif Nazouli of the Intercept piece, Surviving War and HIV, Queer HIV Positive and Running Out of Medication in Gaza. That does it for our show.
This is 88.5 KRFY Pondere.
Well, good morning, KRFY listeners, and thanks for tuning in to the morning show today, Wednesday, January 15th. I'm Susie Prez, along with Chris Bessler. Good morning, Chris.
Good morning, Susie. How are you doing today?
I'm doing fine. It's been a while since we've been face-to-face in the studio, so here we go. This will be fun. And today we present to our listeners City Talk, the 2025 edition here in January, with Sandpoint Mayor Jeremy Grimm, along with new Public Works Director Holly Ellis. Thank you both for coming in today.
Oh, it's a pleasure to be here.
Good morning. Thanks for having us.
Well, we have a lot of stuff to dig in about the city. There's always a lot of stuff to dig in about the city there with Mayor Grimm. But Susie, lay some weather on us first.
The weather from the National Weather Service. We have currently 23 degrees outside. High today will be 39 with sunshine. Okay, time to get out and walk, right?
Yeah, sunshine, amen.
Yeah, low tonight, 27. This almost doesn't look like us for some reason, but and high tomorrow, 37 with a low of 21. And I think we're going to get a little colder the end of the week, but let's enjoy the sunshine while we can, right, folks?
Absolutely.
Okay.
Yeah, and of course, there's a lot of things going on around town. I'll mention just a few before we get into today's talk. The CHAFE registration opens today, actually, if you want to ride in the CHAFE ride. Have you ridden that?
I've ridden it three times.
Okay. The whole 150?
The 150 I've done twice.
Okay.
What is the CHAFE, just for our listeners who might not know?
It actually stands for Cycle Hard for Education. And it is a ride that starts in Sandpoint. It winds up into Bonners Ferry, and then down the Bull River Road and back to Sandpoint along Highway 200. So that route is 150 miles. It's a pretty hefty ride.
It's an all-day event.
Yeah. But you can take off. They have shorter routes as well. You can actually start in Troy, and that's an 80-mile ride that I've done a few times. They also have 40 and 25-mile routes, and they also have a couple of gravel rides now that look pretty intimidating to me. There's like 6,200 feet of vertical gain.
Yeah, and the name is appropriately named as well. It's more than just cycling hard for education. Yeah. You do get a little chafe.
You can chafe a bit as yes. well. Anyways, it's a big fundraiser for education in our town. The ride itself is in June, but you can go register right now at chafe150.org.
And hats off to the Sandpoint Rotary. They've been putting that on for over a decade now. So
yeah, it started with the Panhandle Alliance for Education. Yep. They launched it, and then the Rotary took it over.
Bravo.
Yeah, good stuff.
Time
also,
to register.
Of course, the Banff Mountain Film Festival is happening Friday, Saturday, and Sunday. Word to the wise, if you want to go see the films, you better get a ticket because they almost always sell out. And then actually tomorrow, the Reader is having a community party at Matchwood. So those are a few of the things going on around town. Of course, there's a ton more. There's live music around town and a variety of events. You can see more on our website, krfy.org. Go to the community calendars. You can get details on the ones I mentioned, plus see all the other events.
And if you're really bored, there's a city council meeting tonight at 5:30, 1123 Lake Street.
No. If you wish to engage in your city decision-making, you would go to that
and get
informed about stuff. Yeah.
Absolutely.
Not boring at all.
No. It's going to be quite a lively meeting, actually.
All righty. Should we get going, Chris?
Sure. Well, let's start out, Holly, we're going to want to come back and introduce you to the community and learn more about your background. But, first we just hit kind of a milestone for you, Mayor Grimm. You've been in office for a year now. What would you say are some of the highlights, and you could even mention lowlights, of your first year?
Yeah. A year flies by. It's been, absolutely incredible. I can't describe what a privilege it is to, come to City Hall every week, and it's going very well. If you happen to pick up a copy of the Bee or the Reader tomorrow, you'll see my year-end wrap-up in the editorial and sort of what we're working on this this coming year. You know, the highlights, if you're not aware, my first day in office, the city administrator resigned, and we've transitioned back to a department head, you know, format of government, which was the traditional format pre-2016 that had led the city for, you know, decades and decades. And that's been a pretty transformational process. What it's really done is it's taken the voice of the city away from an individual administrator, and it's really dispersed that across seven department heads. And those department heads are able to make decisions. They're accountable. They're experts in their field of practice, and they're giving updates at every council meeting. So the city council has the opportunity and the public to hear what's on the plate, what they're working on, really hold them accountable for their reports and the management of the city. So that's been a tremendous you know, success in my mind, and I think provided a lot of benefits to the community. Beyond that, when I came and came into office and ran for mayor, my focus was really on, you know, three things, which were reorganization of the administration, focusing on our infrastructure, and really prioritizing taking care of what we have and focusing on our needs over our wants. So as we look at how that's played out, we have started working on our preliminary engineering report. If you're not aware, our sewer plant, our wastewater treatment plant, is in excess of 70 years old. It's at the end of its, well beyond the end of its useful life. And we're going to try to rebuild a new wastewater treatment plant. Holly has been a big part of that, leading the engineering team that is working on that preliminary engineering report. And we've got to the point now where we have a rough estimate of what those costs are going to be, about $130 million. So in the next 6 months, we'll be working on financing and a package that will allow that to be funded. And then we'll go into design of the new wastewater treatment plant. And if the stars align, we will be breaking ground hopefully sometime in late 2026 or early 2027. And then finally, we finished a bunch of projects, the James E. Russell Center indoor facility and some parks, and just continue to focus on the economic diversification of our community and working on our infrastructure. So it's been a very active year, and a lot of fun stuff. And I can't forget, we restarted our citizen committees. We now have five committees that range from parks and pedestrians to sustainability and accessibility. Those committees are critical. We've got dozens of volunteers who are holding those positions. And those citizen committees are critical because they provide the council and myself with some really great feedback and help to also disperse information of what the city's doing in a variety of fields. So in short, it's been a wonderful year having a lot of fun. And hopefully the public is supportive of what we've done and where we're going.
Wow. Congratulations on your first year. It sounds exciting and a lot of changes. You moved away from the city administrator model into this new department head, not new, but back to. Mm-hmm. And how is that going? A little bit more, but did you create any new departments during that transition?
Yes.
That time?
Yeah, so it's going really well. We did create a new department from, and if the listeners aren't aware, I was a department head from 2007 to 2015 at the city. I was the planning and community development director. The department head, the new department head we created is a central services director, and that person oversees Cheryl Hughes. She oversees our IT and our city clerk and our HR, and also all procurement and contracts that the cities enter into. So it's a big role. But how's it going? It's going well. This is a part-time job, Mayor, and What the format looks like now is on Tuesdays, I go in and I meet with department heads individually. We spend about an hour with each department head and talk through the challenges and, you know, roadblocks and how can I help or assist or move things forward. On Wednesdays, we have a group department head meeting where we all collaborate and discuss and share what's happening. And then I'm just in for a little bit Thursday morning to sign contracts or meet with people. So what it's allowed is this part-time mayor's job to actually go back to a part-time mayor's job. I think it's been great. There's a lot of collaboration. One of the fears people had was, you know, these department heads are going to be siloed and they're going to only care about their department. And I can tell you that that is absolutely not the case. The department heads cross-collaborate. They work together. And, you know, the stability it's provided has been great. Under this format, we lose maybe one department head from attrition or a job change. We're not as susceptible as we were under a single city administrator, where if you lost that administrator, you're dead in the water. So overall, I think the public will see that it's much more accessible to speak with these department heads, have meetings with them, and ultimately they are accountable and can make decisions for their departments in their field of expertise.
Mm-hmm. Well, you mentioned Central Services, a new department that you set up, but the other five departments are Planning, Building, Public Works and Utilities, Parks and Recreation, and Finance.
And there's a six also legal. We have a contract with Lake City Law, who's our legal team.
Okay, so that forms another department for you. So is there a Parks and Recreation director?
Jason Welker is our Community Planning and Development Director, and under that is the Parks Program and Recreation Program.
So he kind of heads both departments.
Correct. Yeah. It's a big big job.
Mm-hmm. Okay. Well, we just happen to have one of your department heads here. It's Holly Ellis, and Holly, you're now the new Public Works Director. So tell us a little bit about your background, how you wound up here, and as well, let's talk about what your role is.
Yeah, thanks. My name is Holly Ellis, as you said. I'm not new to the city of Sandpoint. I started out as the construction manager for the city, so I was working under Public Works. I worked on a lot of street repaving programs, water mains, sewer mains. So that's what I've been working on for the past almost 4 years at the city. I come from Maryland, so I grew up in Maryland. I was there my whole life. I graduated high school, had no idea what I wanted to do. I started out as a business major, and I went to community college just because I didn't know what I wanted to do. I heard about civil engineering, so I went down to school in North Carolina, got my civil engineering degree, and then my husband and I moved to Seattle, got my first consulting job out there working as a civil engineer, working on a lot of utility projects, stormwater, wastewater, for a private consulting firm, and found my way here in Sandpoint, Idaho. My parents retired out here, and so my husband and I kind of followed them a little bit. We would visit all the time and loved it. So I figured, why not move out here?
So your husband's able to work from Sandpoint as well? Yeah.
Yes, mm-hmm. Yes, he's got a job here.
Mm-hmm. Okay, well, Public Works has got to be a huge thing right now because you already mentioned the infrastructure needs that we have, specifically with the wastewater treatment plant and roads, mm-hmm. which is probably the most visible thing for mm-hmm. most people just driving around. So, Holly, how are you engaging and how are you going to attack those two big chunks of infrastructure?
We have huge challenges here in Sandpoint. And Public Works often is in the background. People don't know things are going on back there until something goes wrong. So unfortunately, our streets have been neglected. We have a lot of repaving to do to get our streets up to shape and where they should be in alignment with the national standard. And then our wastewater treatment plant, toilets do flush, and our crews work really hard every day to make sure that the plant is still working, making sure that all the sewage is treated before it's discharged to the river. But it's a lot of work that they're working on. So it's something every day we've got challenges. But that's kind of what the fun piece is for me. I really enjoy infrastructure projects. I really enjoy all the utilities. We've got a really good team that I mentioned who works hard really every day. So it's kind of a fun dynamic of having these fun challenges, having a really good team to support that infrastructure, and then responding to the public. So it's important for the public to know that if there's an issue, give us a call. We do want to hear about that pothole. We can't be everywhere all the time. Give us a call. We'll go out and fix it. We also want to fix it. So It's truly a partnership.
Mm-hmm. So Public Works is the roads and maintenance of the roads, all that kind of stuff. What's the scope besides the wastewater?
Oh, great question. I'll take a step back. So our Public Works Department is our streets. So all of our paving, our sidewalks, our tree, urban forestry is part of that. It's also our stormwater, our water utility, distribution and treatment from our Lake Ponderay. And we have a Sand Creek water treatment plant up on Schweitzer. And it's also our wastewater, so our sanitary sewer system and our wastewater treatment plant.
Mm-hmm. Kind of like the bones of the city.
Yeah, the bones of the city. And, you know, I bring to being mayor a philosophy that, you know, the private sector does a great job with housing and business and commerce. If the city can, you know, provide the infrastructure, we live in the greatest country in the world, and the private sector will do the rest. And we're seeing that on a variety of fronts. So, and I just want to also emphasize, you know, we talked about the wastewater plant. If you tune into tonight's council meeting, we've got another pretty significant challenge, which is our water transmission system. We have a great resource in the lake and great water rights, great new, relatively new water treatment plant. But our transmission system is really challenging right now. In light of the devastation that's happening in Southern California right now with the horrible LA fires, we will be discussing tonight, we denied new water hookups and expansion of the water system out in Ponderay to a developer. That developer has appealed that denial, and the council will be taking up that denial tonight as well. But we do have some fire flow deficiencies in our system. And when you think about it, the further you get from the water treatment plant, those pipes, if they're not sized correctly, you start to lose pressure. And we've seen so much growth in Ponderay, Kootenai, Whiskey Jack, and outside of Kootenai that we're starting to see some real deficiencies in those fire flows. And what that means is if or when there is a major fire, when they go to hook up to those hydrants, that pressure just isn't there, and they can't fight the fire. So it's a perplexing challenge that's been ignored for too long, and the pressures of growth have really brought this to a head. And the priority this year is to figure out how we address this water system. Sandpoint provides water not just to our residents, but also to these other municipalities and some county areas.
Ponderay and Kootenai specifically.
Ponderay, Kootenai, areas of the county, out by Whiskey Jack and outside of Kootenai. We also wholesale water to Siringo Water District, which is west of town, up Pine Street, and to Northside Water District, which is north of the city of Sandpoint, north of the fairgrounds. So I'll be bringing in a team of legal experts that will help us understand how we can decouple from this system. My goal is to make Ponderay, Kootenai, and other areas wholesale users so that they can plan, build, and maintain their infrastructure that's in their cities, because right now water is an enabler for development, and we are in the unfortunate position where Sandpoint's making some decisions about water service that will affect the growth and development of both Kootenai, Ponderay, but also parts of Bonner County. And I personally don't feel like Sandpoint should be in that position where we're making those decisions. I think those entities and those communities need to be making their decisions about where and how they're going to grow. So this is I can't emphasize how big of an issue this is. We are in a very bad situation when it comes to water pressures outside the city of Sandpoint, and something we will be 100% focused on. And Holly's going to be part of that, as well as some real experts in water system regulation.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it's kind of horrible to think of it, but we could face the same situation as Los Angeles.
Absolutely.
We have such a big urban forest interface here that a fire, big fire, if it was fueled by wind, that's what's happening down there, could just roll right over this town like it did in Maui.
Oh, you're not kidding. I mean, imagine a late August day, hot, you know, fuel moistures are, you know, in the single digits, and we get a 50-mile-an-hour wind, which happens. We could have a catastrophe on our hands. And for the listeners, water pressure, we run this model. It's all computerized, but it's not just, okay, if there's one fire, you know, is there pressure at the hydrant? What they do in this model is they assume a heavy demand day. So our biggest demand days are actually the end of summer when mm-hmm. everyone's watering their lawns and their gardens. So they run a model when everyone's using a lot of water and there's not just one big fire, but there's two big fires. And they look at what do the pressures at all these different hydrants start to do. And it's not a pretty picture. And if, as we've seen in the Palisades fire, if you don't have pressure, you can't fight a fire. So I brought this up to the county commissioners yesterday at their business meeting. And again, the council will be taking it up tonight. But we've got some major work to do on our transmission, water transmission system.
So those cities, Pondere, Kootenai, they're responsible for their own transmission systems, right?
That's the problem. If we could go back in time, I would advise the former mayors and council never to extend city water outside of the city limits. As it stands right now, the Sandpoint City Council also acts as the board of the water utility. Separate money, separate accounting, separate funds. So the utility, the Sandpoint Water System, both serves and maintains those customers outside the city. We build those lines, or the developer builds them and, you know, transfers them. But we have no say or real pulse on what kind of development's going in, or when a comprehensive plan in Kootenai or Pondere is going to change and go from low density to commercial or high density. So you put a 6-inch water line in, and 5 years later, the comp plan in Pondere changes, and now it's going to be a higher density. Well, that water line's not appropriately sized. So you need to rip up millions of dollars of water lines or add to them to, you know, provide water appropriately. So the short answer to your question is no. Sandpoint manages, maintains, and bills and reviews engineering for all water extensions in Pondere, Kootenai, and areas of Bonner County outside of Kootenai.
So that's kind of the difference between wholesaling the water to a community outside of Sandpoint compared to providing it and being part of the infrastructure that they rely on.
Exactly.
But this rapid growth that we're experiencing outside, it is dictating paying closer attention and what can we do to guarantee Sandpoint is adequately provided for.
Right. And my responsibility is for the residents of Sandpoint. And the hardest part about this challenge we're in is we know that there are millions of dollars in excess of 10 and closer to 20 million of water lines that need to be upgraded to solve this problem. The problem is most of those water lines that need to be upgraded are in outside of Sandpoint. They're in Pondere or other areas outside of Sandpoint. So to pay for that, the city of Sandpoint would need to go for bond funding. So imagine the city coming to the residents of Sandpoint saying, we need to borrow $20 million. Oh, and by the way, this $20 million is going to go completely to infrastructure that's going to benefit or upgrade a different city. We're all neighbors in a community, but you're basically asking Sandpoint residents to take on debt to build infrastructure in a different city. So it's not ideal, and we're going to get it figured out. It's going to be a lot of collaboration with Mayor Geiger and some other mayors and the county. And we're going to get to a solution, but it's going to be a process.
Mm-hmm. Well, speaking of sources of funding, the 1% local option sales tax that was proposed on the last ballot, actually over a year ago now, did not pass. So, and listeners may be familiar with that. So yeah. For a period of, 5 years, we had a 1 cent sales tax within the city on anything that was purchased.
Retail sales.
Retail sales.
Yep. And that was for War Memorial Field.
Yeah, and that money was dedicated for the improvements to build the grandstands and fix up the field at Memorial Field. And you proposed that as a funding source for the city. It did not pass. It actually lost by quite a larger margin than I thought it might.
Yeah, we needed 60%. It got 50.8%.
Yeah, just barely a bare majority. So are you going to bring that back?
Well, it's a great question. We still have no adequate funding. Just to put people in for context, our health insurance, like everyone else's, went up about 23% this year as a city. So we had to come up with about $230,000 of additional, undedicated funds to pay for our health insurance. And the city employees paid a lot of that. We still only have, at the end of the day, about $250,000 to $300,000 a year of our general fund to basically put towards streets. In all, we have about $1 million. We have a lodging tax that was passed by the voters. We have about $1 million a year, maybe $1.25 million to put towards streets. So we don't have a sustainable way to fund our repairs. Yes, I'd like to bring the local option tax for streets back to the voters. We'll be, doing some surveys and trying to understand why it didn't achieve its 60% requirement at the ballot. The challenges are multifold here. First, we're going to probably be going out this fall for a bond for the sewer treatment plant. So I want to be aware of what we're asking the voters for and not put too much on the plate. So I don't think I'll be bringing that back this fall, probably next spring for the roads. And if you're not familiar, this last fall, we brought it forward 1% for 25 years. Based on the feedback I get from the public and the survey responses, maybe we bring it back for a shorter duration. But the main thing to think about on this 1% tax is we get a lot of it's a tax on retail sales, including food. We get a lot of outsiders from outside the county and county residents who come to Sandpoint. And when they come to Sandpoint, they use our infrastructure. And this is a great way to have those folks who are visiting or shopping in Sandpoint help to offset the costs of maintaining that infrastructure. So short answer is yes, we'll be bringing that back probably next spring. And probably for a shorter duration and maybe a different mix of projects.
And just for perspective, you said you have $1.5 million for roads in the budget. Normally, how much does that cover and what does it cover?
Go ahead, Holly.
I can jump in here. So the $1 million, it might sound like a lot of money. It sounds like a lot to me, like I'd be able to do that if it was in my own pocket. But if we had $1 million and we put it into our streets every year, that would just maintain our streets. So if folks are okay with the streets conditions that we have out there today, it's $1 million a year to maintain that. It's called level of service.
Basically fill potholes.
Maintain that condition. if we are trying to improve our system and really have better streets, more paved streets, they're in better condition, less cracks, less potholes, we need to spend more than $1 million. So each year we're not putting $1 million into our streets. We're reducing our level of service. We're having more cracks, more asphalt, more paving. The other challenge we have is that $1 million that we do have budgeted doesn't always hit streets entirely. We pay for engineering to develop plans to make sure that we're meeting the proper standards in our state requirements to have engineers design our streets. So while we have $1 million to spend on our streets, it's going to engineering design and it's going to construction. We try to balance reconstruction of our roads, repaving of our roads, surfacing, seal coating, more of the maintenance items. The biggest challenge we also have is that we have a backlog. So we were not maintaining our streets for so long that the low-hanging fruit just to maintain them with a seal coat on top and preserve the street, the streets beyond the maintenance and preservation point. So it's past that maintenance, and we've got to fully go in, rebuild the street, pull all of the sub-base space out, and repave, which is a much more expensive project. So figuring out where our funds come from is going to be a challenge.
And Holly, roughly, what would you guess? Like our Cedar, this year we're doing one street project. It's going to be Cedar from Division to Lincoln, just north of the library. That project, I believe, came in at $2.8 million.
Our engineer's estimate. That's right, 2.8.
So for one, it's about, what, 2.5, 3 blocks?
Yeah, that's all. Just
for one, blocks, one street, almost yeah. $3 million. Yeah. So, yeah.
So that's a good perspective to have.
Right.
I just drove down that section the other day, and I thought, is this one of them?
Yeah.
So,
we've got... And, you know, it all comes back to, I like to say, in the good times, you don't get into financial trouble in the bad times as much as how you spend your money in the good times. And, the last decade has been pretty good times, with federal funding and other things. And we were focused more on big future projects, and this is where I'm trying to turn the ship and really focus on critical infrastructure, again, water, sewer, roads, fire, and police. So that's what you'll be hearing a lot of for me for the next 3 years.
And if you just tuned in, this is The Morning Show on 88.5 KRFY, and we're speaking today with Sandpoint Mayor Jeremy Grimm and our new Public Works Director, Holly Ellis. So let's stay on the kind of the funding topic here, since so much of this comes down to funding, but there's an update to the Development Impact Fee program that's underway. What's that about?
Yeah, so Idaho Code requires us to update our Development Impact Fee every 5 years. This was a major issue I ran on. It hadn't been updated in almost 10 years, actually more than 10 years now. So we started that effort, have a consultant, Tischler Bice, who is working on our Development Impact Fee program. We should have that wrapped up by, I'm guessing, early June. Development Impact Fees are really a critical part of how a city operates. They're authorized by Idaho Code for fire, police, transportation, parks, pathways. One of the areas you're not allowed to use them is for schools, unfortunately, which really needs to be changed at the legislature. But if you think about it, if we're doing a good job at City Hall, we are taking in tax revenue and we are able to maintain our level of service. We don't want to collect too much money because then we're taxing people too high. Storing up a bunch of, money isn't how government should be working. So the growth is the challenge. We have the money, as you heard Holly say, to maintain. It's how do you expand? When you get new residents, how do you expand your services? How do you add new parks? How do you add new, police and fire and paths, new roads? So impact fees are paid by, at the time of building permit, for new folks moving to our community. And it really puts that burden of expanding your services on the folks who are creating that need for new services. Why should any of us who've lived here for 20 years or 30 years or 40 or 50 years have to pay to buy new parkland when we've already built our parks for our community? The fees play an important role, and they amount to, right now, they're about $3,500 for a single-family residence. It's a relatively small portion of a house. I've seen some builders come in and say it's smaller than whether people are going with stainless steel or black appliances. So it's a small portion of a whole house build, but... it's an important piece, and you'll actually be hearing tonight, if you come to the council, we have an opportunity to buy some land for parks with those impact fees, and I'll give a little, when's this airing? Is this airing today?
Yeah, oh, it's live? Live right now.
Yeah, so we are going to approach, we've been working with the railroad just by Kinnexu Health, north of Larch. Behind Napa, there's a old spur of the railroad that has become available for purchase. And we'll be discussing whether we should use those park impact fees to buy that to continue the Dover Trail north, which has been a very popular trail. It provides connectivity through the communities. And with foresight, the past councils and mayors were able to secure that railroad right away. So we will be considering using those park impact fees for the further extension of that trail network.
So how much further north would the trail go?
This offer is just about to all the way behind Super One and those apartments back there and going north almost to the next active set of railroad tracks, if you're familiar. But I would guess a quarter of a mile or so.
Mm. So the residents and those apartments would have access to the trail, which would be
Nice, and then it would connect over to Boyer. Yeah. Mm-hmm. So right now, if you want to walk from along the trail and continue north up to Popsicle Bridge, you kind of are forced to go down Larch and cut through some way around Super One. This would provide that direct access, continuation of the trail by Jack in the Box all the way north behind the apartments up to the south portion of the former University of Idaho property.
Mm-hmm. Does it cross the railroad tracks at all?
No, it does not. Okay. It's not the active tracks.
Okay.
And there are still people in town that vividly remember when that route was trains coming through town, right through town. Yeah.
Yeah, that wasn't that long ago, Chris. 2004, I think, ish.
Right. Yeah, it's when the trains left. So, well, there's a ton of other things to talk about.
I have something, unless you have something right at the top, Chris. When you're talking about the citizens' committees that have formed, and how do they interact and bring information to the department heads? And what are those committees?
Yeah, those committees are arts and culture. That was the one that we had that has continued. It's the only committee that has a paid, dedicated staff member, Heather Upton, who you're familiar with. The others are Parks and Rec, Bike and Pedestrian, American with Disabilities, the ADA Committee, and the Sustainability Committee, and the Urban Forestry Committee. So they have between 5 and 9 members each, great volunteers. They don't get paid. They do a lot of work. Each committee has a designated city liaison that will prepare their minutes and post their agendas. These are open meetings. They meet monthly or more frequently. And in each of their areas of expertise, they are briefed by department heads of what's happening in those areas. They can request plans, studies, information. And then they act as a sounding board for new things. For example, we are considering looking at paid parking down at the city beach and at the city parking lot. And the Parks and Recs Committee will be briefed on that proposal, and they will make a recommendation and give some feedback to the city council. One of the things I want to emphasize, if you followed along the James E. Russell Sports Facility, that did not get vetted through a Parks and Rec Committee. So as a result, we had some city staff who were the leaders of that project and frankly took a lot of criticism that they shouldn't have for implementing the direction of the city administrator and the council. So one of the hopes and goals of these committees is those committees start to be, I'll call it the tip of the spear. They are the ones who we're going to listen to and maybe not always adopt their recommendations, but they are going to be the ones who are vetting, giving advice, and really making recommendations on our projects. So I think by doing that, it broadens the group that's involved. They'll be providing input on specific design elements. They'll be providing recommendations. They'll be going to their neighbors and friends and clarifying all the misinformation that's on social media. They'll be a really valuable part of this process. So, they're going to be really beneficial to our community.
Kind of a clear and informed voice.
Yes. Back. Yes. Yeah. An honest sort of sounding board of, because any given day opportunities come up at the city, grants become available. You want to be nimble and certainly look for opportunities. So rather than just coming up with an idea and reacting to an opportunity and coming to the council and making a decision, we take this extra step now where we'll bring them to the committees and commissions, and they will provide that buffer and that recommendation.
Mm-hmm. Well, since you mentioned the James Russell Sports Center, mm-hmm. let's check in on that. It opened just a little more than a month ago, and how's that going?
You know, from what I hear, it's going very well, highly utilized. People are loving it. We'll be getting a report tonight at the council meeting on exactly what the numbers look like. One of the priorities of this facility were that it is self-funded through user fees. So we'll start to hear how that adoption of membership and by the hour use is working. One of the things that we're also trying to do is expand the utilization of that facility. Right now, it's primarily pickleball and tennis, but Planning and Community Development Director Welker is looking at a variety of other users who could be accommodated in that space, such as lacrosse, baseball, golf, volleyball, basketball.
Yeah.
So we're going to at some point probably have to take a hard look at the numbers and make sure it is working. But if tennis and pickleball isn't footing the bill, we are preparing ourselves to open that up to other paying groups, such as volleyball or lacrosse or others. So, mm-hmm. But it's going well. It's beautiful. If you've not been there, check it out. It's such a needed and beneficial addition to our community. Really appreciate the Russells for that donation.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and of course, it was controversial.
It was
during the construction because of the location of it. Mm-hmm. But now that it's in operation, folks are able to see, there's really is contributing a something that the community needed.
Yeah, change is hard. Change is hard. The controversy about its siting, I certainly can empathize with the community. Those decisions were made before I was mayor. I'm kind of a water under the bridge person. I'm not going to cry over spilled milk. I'm going to look forward and learn from our mistakes and get better. But, going forward, facilities like that, and can't say there's going to be a lot of them because there's not a lot of money, but we'll be vetting those through the Parks and Recs Commission.
Yeah, and that was an amazing $7 million gift from the Russell family that enabled that construction. Now, there are some other things happening right there at Traverse Park. Phase two of the skate park is open, mm-hmm. so that's more than doubled in size,
yeah.
I think.
Yeah,
so with that's lighting. Pretty cool. And there's kids there late at night. I go by. So do you turn the lights on if you're using it? Is that the way it
works? I believe they're on until 9 maybe or 8:30 or something. So,
yeah,
again, another collaboration. We had sponsors. We had donors. It was an all-out effort to get that built. Yeah. But yeah,
per square foot, it's one of the most utilized parks in the city.
I would have to agree.
One of the things I noticed, because I walk that park every day in good weather, is that the older kids are helping the younger kids. It's really a true community place, gathering place, based on the, the skates and things like that.
Yeah, there's a mentorship there. Yeah. It's an interesting, I don't want to call it a subculture, but it's an interesting cohort of folks out there who, there are people in their 40s and early 50s out there mentoring these younger 12 and 14-year-old kids on skating and triking and all sorts of things they're doing out there. So, I think the community loves it. And, it provides a lot of, outdoor space for kids to get the energy.
And there's a playground for little kids. I think it's open because I've driven by and seen a ton of people there.
It's open. So this is a new park. This was also controversial. We ripped out the old park. There was some funding out there and grant funding that made it obviously worthwhile to do that, but it's a accessible park. The world's changed a lot since we used to put in parks in the 80s and 90s. This new park is fully accessible to people in wheelchairs or have disabilities. It's also age appropriate for a broader range of kids. And it's going to have a splash pad, which isn't open yet, obviously because of the weather, but that will be opening this spring. So the park portion is open, the splash pad is not, and that will kind of line out the improvements there at Traverse Park.
Mm-hmm. We're going to run out of time here, but on the long list of things you guys have been working on, the comprehensive plan has been, updates to the comprehensive plan have been adopted, and that was took several years to do that.
Yeah.
It's the first update in...
Since 2009.
Since 2009, so 16 years, I guess. Yeah. So how is it different than the previous plan?
You know, in general, it carries along. I mean, that 2009 plan, that was my first job as planning director here, to build that plan. It mirrors it, very, very similar, kind of themes and veins there. You know, we're talking about a community that, really builds, cohesion, that has a lot of walkability, that looks to its economy and the diversification of the economy. It looks at housing, looks at sustainability, looks at our urban forest, our transportation corridors. So it's the whole kit and caboodle, and it's really that aspirational vision of where we want to be in 15 years. I will say the next step we're going to have to do now is, because we now have this vision, in the past 6 years, 7 years, the city was very active with all these master plans, transportation plan, multimodal plan, parks plan. And now that we have a comprehensive plan, we need to go back and make sure that those sub plans actually align with our comprehensive plan. So we'll probably be revisiting, touching up some of those other master plans to make sure that they are in alignment with the new comprehensive plan. And the next step on that, of course, is the zoning. And we have a full building and planning department now. We are actively starting to work on the new zoning, which will address things like building height, building materials, structures, placement, density, all sorts of good stuff.
Are any of the zone boundaries changing?
Right now, nothing is proposed to be changing, but we are looking at, especially on First and Cedar, you know, the opportunity to incentivize ways to preserve our current urban fabric. You know, we've got a great sort of historic downtown. So we're looking at things like a historic overlay district that might be a little more restrictive in terms of height and materials that are used in the very downtown core.
Mm-hmm. And how does it, dealing with housing, since housing is such a critical need here?
You know, it just speaks to, you know, looking for creative incentives and solutions. The housing situation is, I think we'll see remarkable improvement. We've just met yesterday with a developer who's going to be moving forward with almost 50 units in the downtown. And his goal is to make those the most affordable housing units in the city. Mm. They're relatively small studio housing units, but with nice amenities like granite and stainless steel. So that's a project. But we've seen over 150 multifamily permits this year, as well as over 50 single-family residential units. In total, in the pipeline, we've got hundreds and hundreds of housing units being planned, developed, and worked on. So I think we're going to see the housing market become much more affordable simply thanks to all the new inventory that's coming
on. Supply and demand.
Supply and demand.
We hope.
And keep it. And at the same time, keeping an eye on our ability to facilitate and support and provide services.
Right. And traffic. You know, one of the things people will observe is, you know, if you get single family housing developing, it's one house or two houses at a time. When you have a multifamily or apartment unit going in, it opens up and boom, now you've got 40, 50 units. Each unit drives approximately, you know, 7 to 9 car trips a day. So, you know, we just opened up Ridley Village down there west of town. You'll see, I think, almost 40 units available down there. We're going to see some behind Super One. We're going to see some up behind the rodeo, the fairgrounds, several hundred up there.
So how does that impact traffic flow, right, things like that?
Well, part of what Holly didn't get to speak to is she and the engineering team look at things like traffic studies that look at trip generations. And that's where our impact fees come in, because we do charge new development by the trip or by the bedroom, how many trips it's going to generate. And those dollars then flow back into our capital improvement plan and pay for a portion of those improvements. Mm-hmm. For example, the new reversion of Pine and Fifth there, the two-way, a portion of that was paid with impact fees. And we'll be looking at Ontario Street in the near term. That alignment, Ontario and US 2, is horrible. Holly will be looking at that with an eye towards... very dangerous. Probably the most dangerous intersection in the city. Holly will be looking at that for a realignment. That'll be paid for in part by development impact fees. So the new growth is paying for those improvements.
One specific development that got a lot of ink here just recently is a proposed FedEx distribution center. Or supposed to be, that's the guess, that's what that that potential permit is for.
Yeah, Great Northern and Woodland Drive. There is a active project there. The company that is representing the developer, if you do a little research, and some of the public has done some research, not FedEx, it looks like some of the public saw that there's another large retailer that will be occupying that, or distributor. So that project is moving forward, and I expect that to break ground in mid to late January.
Oh, really?
So they got the permit.
There were a couple permits they needed. The first was a short plat, which splits the land about 8 acres for this site. I believe the actual facility is closer to about 25,000 square feet, and that'll be a site plan development permit and then a building permit.
Mm-hmm. Does that business bring in jobs?
It's my understanding, from what I've heard, and I have not heard much. And I just want to be clear, if you followed this, the developer submitted plans and they redacted or blacked out the name of the business. I'm not going to say that name because it's public. You know, you can see it out in the record, but and maybe you want to say it. But someone in the public was able to unredact that.
Yeah, they just put a black mark over a PDF, and then people could search within the PDF for the words. Yeah.
So, and people are probably thinking I'm being all sly, but the member of the public said found the word Amazon on there. So, yes, I imagine if it's that, it's going to be dozens of jobs. And, I saw some of the social media comments. There's concern. It's a good debate. Those jobs are year round with benefits. And, that's a big thing. And we've got some other really exciting economic development projects we're working on. I can tell you we're working with one company that may be adding, up to 50 jobs with salaries ranging from $60,000 to $150,000 around the airport. So that is going to be really exciting.
So that will help pay for the taxes on those jobs, and those residents will help pay for the infrastructure that's needed. Our wastewater treatment plant, as it needs, it's a priority, I would imagine, at the city.
Getting back to the wastewater plant, we are so lucky. Our crew down there, Devin, Holt, and others, they have kept that plant running, sometimes with literally duct tape and sewer hose. They have prevented a catastrophe numerous times. We have had some EPA and DEQ violations. It's only by the grace of God that we haven't had a catastrophe down there. So unfortunately, because they've done such a good job, the way the state funding works is if you're not having these catastrophes, you don't rank as high in the need funding. So kind of a catch 22 there, but we are going to be moving forward with a plan to replace that and a funding mechanism to replace that plant.
We're going to run out of time, but I guess squeeze in one more question as pertains to the rebuild of the Edgewater Hotel.
Yeah.
And the parking requirement for that project was reduced, I believe. And at the same time, you reported, I think, suggesting we might want to look at fees for parking at City Beach.
Right. Yeah. Thanks for
bringing expand on that, please.
Yeah. Thanks for bringing it up. There's been a ton of misinformation in the community about that. And I'm always struggling whether you engage in social media to clarify that or not. I really try not to, but
it's a bottomless pit.
It is. But here are the facts. We did not make any special concessions for the hotel. In our code, there are two provisions that they took advantage of. And I don't say advantage in a bad way. They're available to any property owner. The first is anyone can buy up to 50% of their required parking. They can buy it off. You can pay something called an in-lieu fee, and that's $10,000 per space. So in this case, the hotel has decided to buy 40 of their required parking spaces by paying $400,000 into an in-lieu fee, which we will then use to improve parking in the city. The second provision that they used is you can do a site-specific, use-specific analysis of your parking demand. Instead of using this generalized book that we have from all over the country, you can do it just on your region and your location and your use. They chose to do that. They mirrored a hotel in Whitefish, which is fairly similar to us, and they looked at the parking demand there. And that engineering report came back and said, this is how many parking spaces we actually need. So that is the provision that the code allows, and they chose to do that, and the city accepted that. So they're still going to build a heck of a lot of parking, and we're going to use some of those in lieu fees to match a grant, hopefully, to improve City Beach. Now, that's a Band-Aid. City Beach hasn't been repaved or improved in over 30 years. Once we get that improved, I want to look towards paid parking so we have a long-term sustainable mechanism to continue to maintain and take care of City Beach. And that's probably going to be a couple bucks an hour, you know, to park down there. So I don't think that's with a nice discount for Sandpoint residents. Well,
that one will be a controversial one, I'm sure.
Yeah,
already is, probably, but it is. It's something that I'm sure the council will weigh in on as well. Jeremy Grimm, our mayor, and Holly Ellis, our public works director, new one.
Yeah, thank you for the work you're doing. And just a reminder, a city council meeting tonight.
5:30.
At 5:30. And so get involved. This is our city. So thanks for the work you do.
Thanks, Chris and Susie.
Yeah.
Thanks for coming in. So that's about it. I just want to remind you that tomorrow, Jim and Jack will be on the morning show with Robin Campbell and Patty Erickson from the Kinnicksu Native Plant Society. And we have a song that to go out on. Anything else, Chris, real quick?
Nothing else. We're about out of time. So let's hear some music. Goodbye.
Holly picked this song, Louis Armstrong.
I did.
What a wonderful world. Thanks. And we need this song right now. So here we go. Have a beautiful day, everyone. Thanks for listening.